Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is Dr. Paul Jaley. If you watch the Coral Ridge program with the late Dr. D. James Kennedy, you've seen Paul Jaley on many, many of our programs. Also, Dr. Jaley was a guest on the Monumento program, or movie, actually, by Kirk Cameron. Paul, are you there?
I am right here.
All right, good. It's a great privilege to talk with you. And first of all, let me just say Happy Thanksgiving.
You too, and to all your listeners.
Good. What was the first Thanksgiving? What year?
The year was 1621. Probably took place around October of 1621 at the first full harvest of the Pilgrims. And, of course, they celebrated that with 90 of their native neighbors. So it was a fairly large celebration. If you want to look at it this way, there were only 5 adult Pilgrim women alive after that first winter. So 5 women hosting 140 people for Thanksgiving dinner. It's probably a very good thing that the native Indians brought most of the food.
Huh. Now, to whom did they give thanks?
Well, they gave thanks to God. In fact, the Pilgrims themselves viewed everything as sacred. They didn't have a part of their life they felt was secular or without God, so they would have given thanks at the meal, of course, asking God's blessing on the meal itself, and thanking God for the peaceful relationships they had with the local Wampanoag tribe and for their survival. In fact, their whole idea of giving thanks was to look at the positive of what God did, because they believed that we didn't have any entitlement and we weren't deserving of kinds of blessings from God. They believed everything they got was gracious.
And who were the Pilgrims?
Well, the Pilgrims were children of the Reformation, which means that they came out of the Protestant Reformation of the 1500s. So they were strongly rooted in the fact of the priesthood of the believer, that Jesus Christ was the only mediator between God and man, and it was through him that you could have a direct relationship with God. They were strong proponents of the Geneva Bible, first Bible, small enough to carry, cheap enough to own, divided into chapters and verses. It was the first commentary as well, with all the notes of the reformers from Luther, Knox, and Zwingli, and whatnot, and Calvin. So the Pilgrims were individuals. They've been called throughout history the people of the book. So they made the Bible their central text, and that's what they wanted to live by. And that's why they saw such corruption in the English established church.
And what are Pilgrims compared to Puritans?
Well, Pilgrims are individuals, since they went to the Bible, the whole Bible, and began to reason with that, they were strong proponents of self-government, or rule from within. The Puritans attempted to reform the church from within, staying in the state-established church, and therefore they were a bit of more of a mixture initially in governmental practice. They had about the same theology the Pilgrims did. They were both very similar there. But the Puritan would be a bit more top-down in their government, a bit more austere in the sense of wanting things to be changed in ceremony, whereas the Pilgrims believed that they should return to the primitive church, the early church type of worship service, which meant that they weren't too concerned what kind of building they were in. They weren't too concerned about ceremonies. They, in essence, derived the church service that we've become so familiar with in Western civilization and Protestantism. They've kind of formed that directly from the scriptures.
Hmm. You mean, you're saying that, for example, in the average church this coming Sunday, your average Protestant church, let's say, the worship service itself would be similar to what the Pilgrims themselves, just a small little one individual congregation way back when, you know, in the 1600s, that they essentially developed based on what they read in the scriptures, and that's what we have today?
To a large degree, yes. I mean, obviously the Puritans had a similar form, but the Pilgrims themselves would begin with an opening prayer, an exhortation. They would have song service, of course, of singing psalms. In fact, their song service went almost 45 minutes to an hour singing directly from the psalms. And then they would have, of course, their offering for the poor, their offering for the sanctuary. And then they would have almost a two-hour message and exhortations. But those elements, the worship, preaching, in the order in which it's in, is very similar today. Now, obviously, today we have much shorter services.
Yeah.
So we would say that wouldn't be the case. But the Puritans were a bit more ceremonial initially. The Puritans, of course, came over to the Pilgrim way of viewing things when they after the revolution, or just prior to the English Revolution, and came over here to the New World. So we can't say it's exclusive, but at the same time, there's no question that the Pilgrim Church Service, originating to demonstrate Christ freely from the hearts of people, yeah, it's very similar in Western civilization today.
Hmm. Now, and you say the Puritans were similar to the Pilgrims in their theology, but not in the way...
Not in the same way they would practice. In other words, they would be okay with appointments of leaders without a congregational vote. They would be individuals that initially, again, having been in the state-established church, John Robinson, pastor of the Pilgrims, who never did come over to the New World, made these distinctions very clear in his works, that those that stayed within the Church of England tended to have men's trappings and things that they would do in the service that weren't directly derived from the simple teaching of the Word of God. So, for instance, John Robinson would say that we pray from the heart, and yet those in the established church simply pray prayers. Now, obviously, you know, we've seen more balance today. There's nothing wrong with written prayers if they're scriptural and whatnot. But the point is, that's where the Pilgrims drew that distinction. They had more lively songs. They had a more prominent rhythm. Oftentimes they would raise their hands when they prayed, sang, or clapped, whereas the Puritans would be a little more staid in their worship. So certainly the Pilgrims had those distinctions. Now, later on, John Robinson would recognize that you don't separate just to separate, and you don't worship your separation. And he recognized that initially he didn't want anyone to have communion with those that stayed in the established church, but that was modified. Really, communion you could have with anyone that was truly a Christian.
Mm.
So, you know, whenever you go through periods of time like that, the Pilgrims, of course, were called separatists. That was not a compliment. That was derogatory to them for separating from the state-established church. And I might add, doing it was illegal.
Yeah.
So they were actually conducting an underground church.
Hmm. And going just one last question about the Puritans before we move on and just focus primarily on the Pilgrims themselves. And that is, would the Puritans have been using the same Bible, that is the Geneva Bible? Let's say 10 years after the Pilgrims came in the Mayflower, you have John Winthrop leading all those Puritans coming to Boston, Massachusetts, essentially in the wake of the Pilgrims coming 10 years before. Would they have been carrying with them the Geneva Bible, or would they have been users of the King James?
Probably would have been a mixture of both, because the King James is becoming quite popular and did become the most popular Bible in England soon after the Pilgrims left in the next few decades. But there would have been some who would have brought the Geneva Bible. I think John Winthrop, particularly, his heart was fairly closely knit with William Bradford's. In fact, they struck up a greatly great relationship. Because most of the Puritans who left England and came over had already had a change in their heart regarding separating from the Church of England. So those that would come over in Winthrop's wake would be a bit more in agreement with the Pilgrims.
Okay. All right. So the Pilgrims themselves were a group of Christians who were separatists. Dr. D. James Kennedy, the ultimate founder of this radio station and, of course, speaker on the Kennedy Classics, he once made a very interesting observation. He said, when you look at the Pilgrims and what they did, essentially what you're talking about is a church relocation project.
That's right.
That's a fascinating. Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. And in fact, that's something that Americans probably know little about, and that is that what made the Pilgrim migration from England to America in 1620 so unique was not just the fact that they would go across the ocean and come to a new world, because there were others that had done that before, and of course the Puritans would do that afterwards, and that's exactly what happened in Jamestown also, 13 years prior to the Pilgrims coming. But what made it so unique that they came as families, but even more significant, they came as a church congregation. It was the Leiden Church from Leiden, Holland, that came over. It was a church planting project, a church migration project, because most of these families, now not everyone, there were some strangers to the church that came over as well, but most of the heart of those that came over, the 75 or 80 that eventually came here, were from that Leiden congregation, and this was a church that knew each other. These were families that knew each other.
Hmm.
In fact, since whole families didn't all come on the Mayflower, there were some who left children, wives, husbands, back at the in England, they were left with other church members that they were in covenant with. So it was a tight-knit church of about 300, and you might say about 75 of that 300 ended up in New England.
But now, going back to this particular congregation, you mentioned Leiden, which is in Holland, but ultimately these are not Dutch people. These are Britishers who obviously at some point migrated to Holland. So tell us about that.
That's right. In fact, most of those families came from various parts of England, found each other, were worshiping together in Scrooby, England, and other parts, and some had not even met each other till they were in Holland. When they went to Amsterdam, initially, Amsterdam was the city for refugees that were Christians, that were getting persecuted in England. But when they came to Amsterdam, most of these believers couldn't get along with each other. So after a year of having the church there, after they had to flee England, because remember King James said, I'll harry you out of the land, he said they were not free to stay, and neither were they free to leave. So the pilgrims, after that, does difficult two tries. First, they ended up in jail in Boston, England, and then the second try, they actually got in two parts, first the men, then the women, got over to Holland. They attempted to have their church in Amsterdam. But they were so close to all the controversies. In fact, churches were splitting over the clothing style of the pastor's wife and the very minor issues that we would say are crazy, although, of course, history does repeat itself.
Yeah, it does. It does, Paul. I mean,
later on,
there may be people listening to us right now who've gone through a church split over the color of the carpeting or something, you know, which is really, it's power. It all gets back to power. And this
correct.
Is not the way Jesus intended things. You know, he said the greatest among you is the servant of all, etc.
That's right. And so in order to preserve the peace, Robinson moved his congregation from Amsterdam down into Leiden, and yet he still remained as open as a peacemaker to try to help solve these controversies among the churches in Amsterdam. And so he remained a peacemaker for many years, attempting to do that. Of course, by the time the pilgrims did send out their choice grain, as one historian said, choice grain was sifted and sent to the wilderness, John Robinson would die 5 years later in 1625. So he never did make it over, but he was no question the key leader of the pilgrims. In fact, think of it this way. If you were going to be a church leader, you're a pastor, and you're going to send maybe 75 out of a congregation of 300, who would you send? I mean, in one sense, you would want to send the people with the best character who can make it in the wilderness. But maybe you were tempted to send the people who constantly complain. But the point is, when you did send them and they left, he remained with the individuals over in Leiden that we might say would have been the weaker members of the church. We're not positive, but we recognize that, you know, to do that was amazing. And think of this. What pastor would send out 75 with no pastor? Saying they're self-governed enough to be able to work out their own government among themselves. I mean, they had William Brewster, who was a teaching elder, but they had no official pastor for the first 9 years until 1629. So this is remarkable that these individuals were not only part of a church relocation project, as Dr. Kennedy was so apt to say, but also the kind of individuals that could plant a church and rotate the preaching among Governor Bradford, Elder Brewster, because they were so well taught by their pastor. I mean, that's amazing. You know, I look at that as a pastor myself and say, gee, I should be able to preach my way out of a job.
Wow. Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, when this first group came over in 1620, they were sailing, they said, to the northern parts of Virginia. What did that mean and what happened?
Well, the northern parts of Virginia were up to about where Manhattan is today in New York. Everything was initially called Virginia, all the way up and down the East Coast, and obviously after the Virgin Queen Elizabeth. And so you had the idea that all of this area was Virginia. Now, they had this patent, the northern parts of Virginia, because the pilgrims did not want to get too close to Jamestown. They wanted to be far enough apart to be their own independent colony.
Okay.
At the same time, they had a patent to be in Virginia because the initial company that had started the Popham colony back in 1607 in Maine, that first colony only lasted 9 months, that New England company had gone out of business. So the pilgrims, you know, the only place they could was to come out of the London company and to be able to finance their voyage, much like stocks. They would individuals would buy shares, and each individual would have that, and then, of course, they would pay back from the profits those stocks and those bonds the businessmen put up for them to come. So here they are planning to be in the northern parts of Virginia. They get blown off 500 miles off course. They end up on Cape Cod, and they're outside that patent. So they start to sail south toward Manhattan. They go into dangerous shoals outside Cape Cod and realize it's still so late by this time in December, or early November at least, and knowing that they're going to have to explore, that they decide to anchor inside Provincetown. And that's when they start their 30-day exploration to find a place to settle.
Okay, we're talking right now with Dr. Paul Jaley, who's actually a pastor in Plymouth, Massachusetts. He's been a guest on many different programs. He's a walking encyclopedia, as you can tell, on the subject of the Pilgrims. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. And as we continue this tale, so what happened in Provincetown? I understand they made history in the Mayflower cabin.
Yes, they did. And before they landed, they wrote the Mayflower Compact. And that was because many people on the board were talking about, well, if we're not under the original patent and charter from England, we're free to do whatever we want. Now, the Pilgrims had been schooled in covenant making from their pastor, John Robinson.
Which ultimately gets back to the Bible, right?
That's correct. In fact, their covenant that they formed their church under had this simple premise that you raise to the highest ideal of what you can agree on, and then you agree in due process to work out differences and to do it in a biblical, godly manner. And so they did the same thing for their civil compact that they had done for their church compact. Now, the amazing part of the Mayflower Compact is it begins with the words, "In the name of God, amen," then "we whose names are underwritten," and then "the subjects of the king." So it was God to the people and then to the king, which reversed the power flow that was in England of God to the king and then to the people. So whether they intentionally did that to reverse the power flow, we may not know, but we know this. The document itself was written as a Christian document, and yet it was people in the church and outside the church that would have equal voting rights to vote on the laws. Now, this is way ahead of the time. The average Puritan group that would come in Boston 10 years later, you had to be a member of the church in order to vote in society, in the state. So the state, in essence, was within the church, whereas the Pilgrims had this jurisdictional separation of church and state right in the Mayflower Compact, which is remarkable because they didn't wait for the king. They didn't have permission from the king. They drew it up themselves. What an act of self-government. Hmm. It's been termed, of course, by historians as the cornerstone to self-government. It became the charter of the Plymouth Colony. Later, 16 years later, they wrote a constitution, the Pilgrims did. So in essence, you had the Mayflower Compact as a charter and then the bylaws of the Constitution. In fact, every edition of laws published by the Pilgrims had the Mayflower Compact as its preamble. Now, part of the story is interesting because England didn't accept the Mayflower Compact, so they sent over the Pierce Compact 1 year later, so they would be governed properly. But, of course, the Pilgrims, though they received that Pierce Compact, that made them legal in the eyes of England, but they functioned by the Mayflower Compact.
Hmm. And the Mayflower Compact, of course, mentions that having undertaken a voyage for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, which I think is very substantial. Now, who was the main writer of the Mayflower Compact? Do we know?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we know that by what was written in Mort's Relation, the first published diary in 1622, which was probably Edward Winslow, William Bradford, we can probably be sure that Edward Winslow, probably William Brewster, maybe Bradford, and some of the others, maybe even Samuel Hopkins, because he had been in Jamestown, and he had been shipwrecked on Bermuda and had a lot of expertise also in government and liberty. So who knows? But we don't know for sure, but certainly Bradford doesn't reveal that. But I would imagine probably be the main writers that we see coming up the next 10 to 20 years.
Okay, now, there were how many people on the Mayflower?
About 120 on the Mayflower, 102 passengers, and about 18 crew members.
Oh, okay. And of the 102 passengers, how many were what we would today call pilgrims, approximately?
Probably about 75.
So that's the great majority. Well, who were the other 27?
Well, the other 20 would be members of the Church of England that were being hired, like John Alden for the Cooper. He kept all the barrels in their hold, and he was trying to keep them sealed for grain and for seed and whatnot. Of course, Miles Standish would have been one of those, and he would be of the Church of England. He would have a King James Bible. Miles Standish would be hired as their military captain. So they would call, later historians called them saints with the Pilgrim Church, and strangers. But that was a little bit confusing because though they were not of the Pilgrim Church, they may have been Christians. And there were a lot of them in the Church of England that would have disagreed with Pilgrim government,
yeah,
but would have agreed that Jesus Christ was their Lord and Savior and their only mediator between God and man. So most likely the majority of the 102, a vast majority, were Christians,
right,
but about only 70 to 75 were actually members of the Leiden congregation.
Okay, but furthermore, going in, you know, to these 20 to 27 of them or whatever that were, as you say, historically have been called strangers, not only would they have been Christians, they surely must have been sympathetic to the goals of the pilgrims to settle this new land. I mean, you don't just uproot everything, your whole life. I mean, today we get on a plane, we can be, you know, literally halfway around the world in about 24 hours. But back then, this was their whole life, so they must have been sympathetic to the goals.
Yeah, they would have been sympathetic, especially to the idea that they were going to have this contract where they could make a new start economically.
Yeah.
And they would know that they would be under the laws. And I think one of the, probably the great majority of them would be greatly pleased by the Mayflower Compact because they all had a share in the laws, whether they were a member of the Leiden congregation or not.
Ah, very good.
And that was huge because that meant even, of course, they would all go to the same church because they were all, there was only one church and they would all have to work together. But they had a share in the laws. I often ask people, I said, which would bring greater submission? That if you said, well, the 75 of us that are in the same church, we're the only ones that make the laws, and you guys are going to have to follow them, or whether everyone had a chance to discuss and vote on those laws. You obviously are going to get a greater amount of unity. So it was tremendously wise for them to write that Mayflower Compact and keep that group of people together, or they would have never survived. And, of course, they still had 30 days of exploration before they ever landed on what we now know as Plymouth Rock.
Hmm. Very good. All right. Now, tell us about the relationship the Indians had with the pilgrims, because I understand that lately some Indian groups are upset with the pilgrims, or they mark Thanksgiving as a time of protest. But in reality, it seems like what they're mad at is not the Indians. They're mad at Philip Sheridan, you know, jumping ahead 200 years later or 250 years later and so forth. They're mad at what happened to the Indians in general, but the pilgrims themselves, I understand, were very peace-loving people, even made a long-time peace treaty with the Indians, and were very just to them.
Yes, and I think a lot of it comes when you read through Mort's Relation and you see that the pilgrims did dig up a couple of graves because they wanted to find out more about the natives, and that's looked at as, you know, sacred ground that you violated. At the same time, if you read the same book, the pilgrims recognized that this would not be viewed well by the natives and made a decision not to dig any more graves up. When they dug up the corn that they found and took that corn, they did it after a discussion based on common law that they realized because they might starve and that the soil would not allow their seed that they brought with them to grow, they were going to pay back the natives for that corn, which they did at the time of the peace treaty. So right from the beginning, there was this relationship that we have law. Law is our guideline that if you treat people fairly by law, they will tend to be more friendly. And I think this is what you see in the peace treaty, that here in March of 1621, this peace treaty is ratified with Massasoit, the head of the Wampanoag, and it lasts until 1675. Mm. That's 54 years. Now, it has been said that that's the longest-lasting peace treaty in American history. Now, I don't know if that's exactly accurate, but I'll tell you, it is longer than most of the others. And you're right, a bitterness has ensued because some of the peace treaties made with the Native Americans at the time of the Constitution were violated. And there were actually, you know, relationships. Nobody's perfect. These two cultures were not perfect with each other, either the Wampanoags or the Pilgrims. And really, I think what causes a great consternation is what happened in King Philip's War. And because there were so many peace treaties among the Pilgrims and Puritans by that time with the natives, and even whole villages and praying Indian villages, about 20 of them, established by John Eliot. When King Philip's War took place, and even Christian settlers from England violated the treaty with their Christian brethren who were Indians and put them on Castle Island and said no good Indian but a dead Indian, Yeah, you have a lot of violating of covenant, but it went on both ways, and it went on among the Indians as well. There's no question by the third generation, the veneration that the pilgrims had toward covenant keeping had largely been lost.
Just real briefly, what was King Philip's War?
King Philip's War was a time, King Philip was the son of Massasoit, given an English name in honor of the pilgrims. But King Philip grew up in great bitterness toward the white man and what he thought was the shrinking hunting grounds. Obviously, there were all kinds of land deeds that allowed the white man to hunt. And these, but particularly, I think he was most angry at the Indian villages that were turning and getting converted to Christianity under John Eliot. And it was these praying Indian villages that he detested. In fact, King Philip's War started by King Philip, son of Massasoit, now murdering three Indian pastors of some of these churches, burying their body in Agawam Pond, and starting King Philip's War. So the war actually started with Indian on Indian, non-Christian Indian against Christian Indian, and then spilled over, of course, into the white colonies, which had brought the Christianity here. So in many respects, King Philip's War was a horrible war. It was tremendous loss to both Indian and white man. And the fact is that, but it was also a major spiritual warfare.
Sure.
So to study that war is, no question, a cataclysmic time in New England.
All right, we have just a couple minutes remaining. The pilgrims were really remarkable. Now, it wouldn't be accurate to say that they settled this nation, or would it? I think it'd be accurate to say that they cast a very long and positive shadow toward the United States and helped really create a Christian tone, you know, that carries all the way through to Philadelphia in 1776 and 1787.
I would say that the pilgrims, because they were Christians, they demonstrated something very positive. They weren't perfect. They'd be the first to tell you that. But the pilgrims themselves, in their practice of covenant keeping and solving relational conflicts within their own church and then among the local natives, having a Thanksgiving, which was probably derived after the Feast of Tabernacles, the pattern in the Old Testament, because the pilgrims used the Jewish calendar beginning in March for the new year. And all of those things, they definitely demonstrated that you can get along with people you disagree with. You can set an example that is positive. And you can do so even in the midst of your sinful faults and prejudice and pride that all people are going to have. So the pilgrims weren't perfect, but I would agree they set a very high bar of example unto others. Though they were involved in wars, the Pequot War in the 1630s, the King Philip's War, these are not wars the pilgrims started, but these are wars that they were brought into and did the best that they could. And so I would say that that first Thanksgiving, at Thanksgiving time, we can thank God for the pilgrims, and we can thank God for that example that they gave us, and then learn from their mistakes as they wrote. So I think people should read that paragraph in Mort's Relation about the first Thanksgiving and also of Plymouth Plantation by William Bradford and enjoy that meal set as an example by our pilgrim forefathers.
Paul, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Hey, you too. God bless you.
Okay, God bless. Again, Paul Jaley from the Plymouth Foundation, and he's a pastor in Plymouth. We are grateful to him for all his research on the pilgrims, and happy Thanksgiving to you. We'll be back in a moment with more on Vocal Point.